Herzlich willkommen bei Rettungsdienst FM, eurem Podcast für den Rettungsdienst mit Themen rund um den Rettungsdienst. Bei mir ist wie immer der Frank Weilbacher. Frank, hallo, wie geht's?
Julius, mir geht's gut, wie immer.
Sag mal, was ist denn heute unser Thema?
Ja, heute haben wir ein ganz spezielles Thema und zwar eine Premiere für uns. Wir werden heute das erste Mal in Englisch podcasten. Das heißt, wir wechseln gleich einmal die Sprache und wir entschuldigen uns oder ich mich zumindest schon jetzt mal bei allen Hörern für das furchtbare Englisch. Aber ich glaube, es lohnt sich dran zu bleiben, denn das Thema ist extrem spannend.
Ja, ich bin auch sehr gespannt. Wir werden jetzt diese Folge gleich in Englisch starten und haben dafür ein ganz besonderen Gast aus Polen, Katarzyna Daniszewska. Hello, how are you?
Hi, guten Morgen.
Oh, we could have done it in German. Okay, yeah. You allowed us to call you Kate during the podcast. Thank you very much for that. And
Will no. be easier, definitely.
Yes, I think so, at least for us.
Yeah. My sister-in-law is Polish, but I'm ashamed to say that I can't say one word in Polish. So I'm sorry, so that I just can speak English. I also can offer Japanese, but that's all.
Oh, I don't think we'll find a common ground there. Okay, so shall we start?
Yeah. Okay, Kate, for our listeners, maybe as an introduction, let's start with a somehow strange question. If we take you on a ride on a time machine, and what have you been doing 2 years ago?
Well, before the war started, most of the time I was actually working on oil rigs, so on platforms. And actually, most of the time I was in the German sector, what is actually quite funny.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was part of the rescue team on the platforms. And actually, even the information about the official start of the invasion on Ukraine, I got while being on the oil rig.
Okay.
That's very interesting. Yeah, very
interesting. That could be another show.
Yeah. So you've been working there as a paramedic, right?
Actually, I was not the main medic of the oil rig. I was my main thing was rope access rescue.
Ah, okay.
And I was part of the rescue team, so for firefighting, for everything that was going on, I would be part of the team, and the main paramedic would be cooperating with us as well.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
So, but then the war started, and I think a lot of things changed in your life.
Everything changed around like 180. I decided that I should be one of the people who should go there because I can handle the situation. I can be a good use there. They had, big problems, as you can imagine. I wanted to help, but I wanted to do it in a smart way. So I didn't want to just go straight away the first day I noticed and like, yay, let's go, hooray. So I did a little bit of digging, searching, and I wanted to find an option that would be, well, safe is a funny word for going to a country in the war zone, but they had a lot of problems with very young, inexperienced leaders in some units. I didn't want to put myself for this kind of situation. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go in a trusted environment that they would know how to use me and not send me to death right away.
So you kind of chose your team.
Yeah, so it's basically, I didn't find the best option at the beginning, which I wanted to. And by accident, I actually ran into one of my paramedic friends, Jacob Bawaban, exactly. He started this whole project and movement of paramedics doing, at the beginning, just the transports from like the main hospitals in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Of course, as you can imagine, the whole health system collapsed.
Yeah.
So not only on the front line, they had problems even inside all of the country because the hospitals were overfilled and there was nowhere for the patients to go. They couldn't handle it. And the medics, the Ukrainian medics, they could not pass the border. So at the beginning, we actually just teamed up with some of the paramedics, nurses, and doctors from Poland with our own time, money, our own ambulances, everything. We just created everything from scratch. Well, Jacob basically created it from scratch. And we started doing really big medical transports with many ambulances from the Lviv hospitals mainly, mm-hmm. through the border, Ukraine and Poland, and into the airport of Rzeszów-Jasionka. And from there, airplanes from all around the world, but mainly Europe, of course, they would land and take the patients to many different countries. So we kind of helped with the system at the beginning so it would be more fluent, it would work. And after about 2 months of this kind of work, I created a team of Avangarda and we went directly to the front line.
So what made you, why did you come up with that decision that it would not be enough to transfer people from the hospitals abroad, so to say, but what made you think it was necessary to go to the front line yourselves? So as you said, the risk is a lot higher there, I suppose.
Of course. Well, it was a decision based on the situation. We knew that they really, really need tactical paramedics. They really need medics at the front line. And and many many of the medics that they had were being killed. Mm. So, yeah, I figured there is a need and not many people can actually take this decision. Make this decision, sorry. And me working before in some of security, specialistic security, and not being that young anymore, and also not having, for example, a family with children, I just decided that if anyone needs to go there, it should be people like me.
So people who can look after themselves at least.
Yeah. Hmm. Not leaving children behind and giving them a lot of knowledge and skills that are very, very needed there at the moment.
So what kind of missions do you do now when you go to the front line? Can you describe a little bit how your work looks, how your routine, if you can call it like that, looks like?
Of course. We have a little bit over 20 people now in Avangarda team. It's our main... main actions is medevac, definitely. So we take ambulances. We go directly from Warsaw to Donbas region. We have a place to stay there. We have a base where we sleep and where we can sleep, rest, eat, park our ambulance and get ready for work. And we work in teams of three, preferably. Mm-hmm. And what happens is we, at the moment, because it was evolving and changing throughout the 2 years. But at the moment, it's kind of changed and created into this system like we have in normal paramedic ambulance stations. So we work like 24 on 24. Mm-hmm. So we go for 24 hours to a specific medical base we have common with our Ukrainian friends under a Ukrainian military unit. We wait there with a couple of teams. So, for example, 4, 5, or 6 medevac teams waiting there on hold because we have more, but they're not staying in the same place all at once. Mm. One of the medevac teams is actually at the stabilization point, which is already at the front line. And we are a little bit more in the, let's say, back line of this front line, which is, of course, bombarded most of the time, but it's still a bit safer. And we change. So the team, the medevac team at the stabilization point is working there, helping stabilize the wounded that are being brought there. And if they know that they have a full car to go, let's say, to the field hospital, to the frontline hospital, then we get information on the radio and we have, well, we just go ASAP. So we just stand up, whatever we're doing, we just put on the vest, the helmets, and we go straight to our vehicle and we just go in the direction of the stabilization point because we know they will be leaving soon. So we are rotating all the time. Mm-hmm.
So you switch and take over
yes. The
work at the stabilization point. Okay.
And the next medevac team at the base knows that they will be next.
Okay.
So they kind of are in this, you know, ready to go state. So they're trying not to do something that will take them, I don't know, a long time.
So you are taking the patients or you are taking the stabilization point?
Well, we are coming at the stabilization point, and if there are many wounded waiting to be taken, then instantly we take the stabilized patients and do the medevac with them. The medevac takes about 1 hour. But if we come to the stabilization point and there is not much wounded, then we stay there and we work there until we get a full package to take to the hospital.
So you stay there as long as it takes to fill up your car, so to say.
Yeah.
And then you rotate with the team that is waiting in the background, so to say.
Yes. The road itself, the medevac road, is quite dangerous. It's the worst part of the job. The stabilization point is being like bombarded nonstop, but still it has, you know, thick walls. So it's still much better than being in this can that's going in, you know, well, under thin air. We're trying to usually wait. Of course, if we have a heavy patient, right, a red one, then we'll just go instantly. But if we have some light green patients, then usually we will wait to fill up the ambulance so we don't, you know, risk our lives at this worst possible way, just for one or two patients that are just, you know, sitting like this. they're just basically fine.
Yeah, I can imagine that. So your opponents surely know these routes, and I think this is an easy target, so to say, for artillery fire and so on.
Yeah.
I could imagine.
Yeah, we have artillery, mortars, drones, and rockets aiming at us, like, well, quite constantly. So everything just falls from the sky.
So for our listeners, a stupid question. Ambulance and paramedics and medical personnel are usually during the war protected by the Geneva Convention, and the Russians give a shit. Is that right?
Yeah, I wish. Of course, they don't give a shit.
Okay. They don't give a shit.
Unfortunately, medics are a very good target for the Russians. And, well, at the beginning, there was some speculations about it. If it was, you know, by just accident, statistics, maybe they're not really aiming at the medics, maybe they're just aiming at everyone. No, it's like it's been totally proven now that the medics are just a perfect target. And they are actually looking for us and like hunting us, let's say. And our previous base has been directly destroyed, bombed by two Shahid drones. And, you know, they had specific numbers where they should hit. And it was directly in our medical base, nothing there around.
Okay, they had geodata, so they can they know where you were. And
Yeah, they had coordinates.
Okay.
There was one more story where it went all around the world, where they there was an international team of medics with one of the American doctors. And the Russians basically bombed a civil site. They were there were many casualties that were civilians. And this international medical team, they just came to the spot to treat the wounded. Of course, they tried to do it as fast as possible and to take them out of there. But, you know, it takes time even to just transport them into the car. And the moment the cars, the vehicles stopped on the site, the Russians actually waited for this specific moment and then they fired again in this exact same spot to kill all the medics that came there.
We call this second hit. Usually it's a tactic from terrorists. Awful.
Yeah, really, it's really shocking, but I think this is real life in war, and everything else is nice stories, but has nothing to do with real life, I think. Okay.
Yeah, the truth is quite harsh and unpleasant, but yeah, that's the way it is.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the conditions under which you work? So we are used to working in sterile conditions, good roads, good climate. So we are not outside in winter all the time when it's raining and so on. I can imagine you have a lot more problems than just trauma and being bombarded, but things like... like infections or parasites and all this could also be a problem, I imagine.
Well, first of all, I'm sure you already got this information, this knowledge that we don't have good vaccination standard in Ukraine, right? It's much worse than in Poland, in Germany, in many European countries. So we have to take that into consideration. There is a lot of
TBC.
Yeah, for example, there is a lot of AIDS as well. There are a lot of problems that we dealt with already in Europe before. So we have to take extra caution with that. I already took all the possible shots, vaccine shots before going there, especially in the summer time. I think I was kind of dying in my bed for like 4 days because I got like, I don't know, like 12 all at once. Yeah, so this is one thing. Second thing is... of course, the tactical situation, the places, they changed. We were in different eras, different times, different places. Many times we dealt with lack of electricity, lack of water. We've been in some rotations where we couldn't wash ourselves for 3 or 4 weeks at all. We only used, you know, the wet wipes. that you in mountains. Yes. I did at least. So actually, when I did some mountaineering before, when I still had a life and time, we called it like a Russian shower, you know, with wet wipes. So now it suits perfectly. Nice. Yeah, we didn't have a toilet or actually any place that you could call a toilet. One time we stayed at this old factory only because we had some roof over the head and it was, you know, thick walls. And we actually had to, real story, brace yourself. We had like three floors above us, which was perfect. So we lived and slept in the nearest condemnation, of course. But then when we needed to go to the toilet, so basically we went for shit to the first floor and everyone just found themselves their own corner when they would just basically shit every day. So this, yeah, it sounds really horrible, but these were the conditions and you could not go out and shit outside because they would just, something would fall on your head and kill you. So these were the conditions sometimes. So you had your small corner there. Dust was everywhere. It was really hard to breathe. You could just, you know, see it flying all around in front of your eyes. And each day when it would be bombarded, it would go up even more. So that was also, you know, a small thing, but breathing with this, you would have really, you know, started getting like some respiratory problems when you are sitting there constantly for a long time.
And dust goes everywhere. Yeah? You can hardly protect yourself.
Yeah, and we learned to close our bags all the time to make them, you know, like sealed almost, to hide all the food, everything, because many times when they would bombard us, you know, pieces of plaster would fall off walls and the roof, and it would just fall on everything, on you, on your clothes, on your food, everything. And if the bombarding would be bigger, then if there is any glass left in the windows, it would all go in on you and on the food and everywhere as well. So then you would have to just throw everything out.
Wow, that's quite impressive. Yeah, and I think I think in winter, cold conditions are also a problem. I think.
Oh, winter is the worst, definitely. I'm also just very cold all my life. As a typical woman, I would say actually. I always say that women come from hell and we just miss home. So I'm always cold.
Well, you said that. We didn't.
Yeah, you're free out of charge. I said that. So, yeah, I hate winter, actually. But apart from that, with transports and with the patients themselves, the struggles we mostly have is when not having electricity and not being able to, you know, plug in the ambulance anywhere as well. Even if the electricity is there, we still cannot do it. The ambulance is, you know, hidden under some trees, bushes, or roof somewhere, wherever is kind of safe when it's not visible from the sky. Well, in the winter, first of all, you have to pray for it to always, you know,
to start.
Because the ambulances are not the newest and best cars we have. Second of all, fluids. You know, most of the patients, they're already in hypothermia, they're with massive bleeding. You really want to take care of their thermals. And there is a problem because you're trying to take all the fluids to make them warm inside somewhere. But if there is no electricity at the moment, you don't really have much options to make them warm. And you know that active warming is the only way to go as well. And the fluids at least should be the temperature of the body, if not, well, they should be more. And also, you know, the drain yes. right? Yes. It will lose the temperature on the way as yes. well. Mm-hmm. So many problems with that. When we stayed at some places where there was no electricity and very cold inside as well, we actually went into our sleeping bags and all our clothes, coats, caps, mm-hmm. everything. And we would actually put them underneath our armpits, okay. the fluids. We would sleep it, you know, like salt and wringer underneath okay. our armpits and like between our legs and okay. whatever we do, at least so they wouldn't be freezing.
Yes.
So that was the worst option for this. Now it's a bit better. The conditions got better after 2 years. Well, it's a normal thing. Everything, you know, is being taken care of. Many thoughts, many people, many donations and money that are getting the situation better. Mm. So at the moment, in most places, we actually usually have electricity. If something wasn't bombed directly, we have access to electrical power. We have some generators. And we are able to keep the fluids very warm for the patients. So thank God that's a plus for now. What else seemed to be a big problem at the beginning? We also lacked at the first stabilization point, to be exact, when we came. It was very small, very basic. They had just a couple of people from the medical personnel, and actually only two of them were doctors. One was a surgeon, and the rest was actually not medical. They were, you know, the like morale patch medics mm-hmm. after a course. So of course they did a good job, but they were not medically
trained.
Educated. Mm. Yeah, they had, you know, like 1 month, 2 months, 3 months training at most, which was actually already good because some of them have 3 second training. So attaching the patch and you're a medic. Good job.
Take the first one that you get and put a medic patch on.
Go for it.
Go for it. So this sometimes happens, unfortunately. That's the truth. But yeah, they had those that were actually trained at this point. But because of lack of equipment, money, logistics at that time, they actually didn't even have IV access.
Okay.
They only used intramuscular injections. Mm. So, you know, most of the wounded, of course, they were after massive bleeding.
Yes.
And you can imagine they didn't have any IV access and not, of course, not IO as well, nothing. Mm-hmm. They just used the painkillers and I'm looking for the English word for it. Vomiting.
Anti-emetics, yes.
Yes, thank you. So yes, everything went intramuscular and that's it. So when we saw that the next rotation, we took everything we could find ourselves with our Polish friends, whatever equipment we could take, we did, and we started doing a lot of IV fluids and everything else that was needed there. From something interesting that was very new for us, for example, we found that at the first stabilization point, some of the medics were using caffeine IV.
Ah, okay. And did it work or?
We were laughing that it's kind of a placebo effect more. Oh. You know, it does bring the pressure up a little bit, but with the pressure going down because of massive bleeding, it's really a placebo effect, right? It's just very, very small.
But yeah. Sometimes you're wondering if you're more starting at work and if you should take your coffee IV.
Yes, maybe it would help.
Yeah, we had the maybe same helps job. That's
for
why
the personnel, maybe.
We always said we would just IV like for a constant, yes. right? We would walk around with coffee everywhere. Yeah. So, yeah. I even took one ampoule with me for, you know, for remembering it as a souvenir.
Yeah, you should keep it.
Yeah, the ampoules were actually, you know, Soviet, old Soviet ones.
It might be very, very, might be very interesting someday for a museum or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. So you briefly talked about your teams and how they are composed. Is there you also talked about doctors. Is there any kind of standard composition that you try to achieve? For example, do you try to take one doctor with every team, or do you try to take at least one experienced person with the team, or how do you deal with this availability of different kind of training in the people you get?
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you how we do it in our team, in the Polish team of Avangarda, and I'll tell you how it looks like at the stabilization points as well. In our team, as I said, we're doing it as a three-person team, and we want one main medic. And in my opinion, it doesn't have to be a doctor, but it should be a good medic. So if it's a good paramedic with nice experience, that's fine. But if it's a nurse with nice experience in this specific medical field, it's fine as well. And if it's a doctor, it's even awesome as well. But the doctor also needs to be in this specific field, right? Because if it's, let's say, for example, a dentist or some kind of doctor that is not really, you know, in the emergency medicine area, he's not really that of a plus in the team. So yeah, main medic that knows what he's doing. The second team member is whoever can actually help him. So it's an extra medic usually, or a student of medicine, which sometimes happens if he's you know, eager to learn and work, and he has some experience already as well. That's fine for us as well. And the third person is always a really good tactical driver. And we really want everyone in the team to have some kind of medical course. Not everyone has to be medical in the sense of university, but the driver doesn't really work that much medically, right? He has to focus on getting the team alive. To the stabilization point and with the patients to the hospital. He needs to know how to drive so we don't lose the wheels on those roads that are really bad. He needs to know how to adjust to bombing, to mortars, to artillery when they are actually aiming us. And still to go as fast as possible with the heavy patients. And of course, very important, how to communicate with the team working with. Especially because of the road conditions. So that's our usual team. So it's perfect when we have three really good medics and one of them is the tactical driver, but that's not always the case. Mm. That's fine. We deal with that as well.
So it's, and so it's actually one doctor, one paramedic, a nurse, and a driver with some
usually
experience.
Usually that's the team.
Okay, it's actually a classical ambulance in some way.
Yeah, like the specialistic one, right?
Yeah.
Yes, and at the stabilization point, do you have different team compositions or?
So. The stabilization point itself, well, there are many kinds of stabilization points, of course. We have like really small and basic ones. Some of them are really actually in their like red zone, just, you know, even in the trenches.
Mm.
And some of them are actually quite big and really operative and professional. And you can even do basic surgeries there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the conditions are nothing like in the hospital, but yeah, it's possible. And our stabilization point at the moment is actually quite big and professional. And there is always a team there, which is only working at the stabilization point. So there is always one main surgeon, Ukrainian surgeon, mm-hmm. who is the main doctor of the stabilization point. So it's his point, and he makes all the important decisions, of course. He's like the main medic. And there are usually two or three more doctors there as well at the big stabilization mm-hmm. point, of course. We're saying about like one of the biggest ones. And there is around, I would say, like, you know, 10 or 20 more people that is actually there. And they just rotate. Some of them sleep, okay. some of them work, you know, so mm-hmm. 24 and 24 maybe. It depends, of course, on the number and dynamics of the wounded coming in. And the rest of the people are usually, they don't really have paramedics. They don't really have too much nurses at the front line. They have mostly doctors, or they have the soldiers that are after some courses, basic courses. So it's like a first aid plus plus, specifically for the frontline work.
So you already talked a little bit about different categories of injuries, and I scrolled around a little bit on your Facebook page, and the pictures there are very impressive, I think. Yes, and I saw a lot of injuries that we typically do not encounter in civilian EMS, or at least rarely. And can you tell us a little bit about what you typically see, what injuries you treat, and what experiences maybe you gained with this typical kind of injury and treatment options for that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so first of all, in the former conflicts, we were used to Iraq, Afghanistan, right? And most of TC3, of course, is based on that, which is obvious. At the moment, at least. What's changed, for example, is before we were focusing on a lot of bullet wounds, shot wounds, and we had a lot of IEDs, right? So explosions and shot wounds, basically. At the moment, we don't really encounter a lot of shot wounds directly. Mm-hmm. But we really have a lot of, I forgot the word, sorry.
Shrapnel injuries? Or?
Yes, thank you. So there is really a lot of that. It's flying everywhere. And as you know, these are actually the worst wounds, much worse than the shot wounds. Also, apart from pieces of like rockets, bombs, they are that are flying. You have pieces of vehicles, right? Of tanks. You have pieces of the trees that are around you. You have pieces even of your colleague that was standing mm-hmm. next to you. And of course, if they enter your body and they reach a place with a hard bone, for example, we know that the bone can actually start acting the same way. So, yeah, a big problem with treating those wounds, a lot of work with them. And I would say that's like 80% of the injuries on the front line in Ukraine. Now we have a rise in all amputations mm-hmm. as well. Unfortunately, we have an increase of mines and drones. So both of them create the situation where a lot of soldiers just come to the stabilization points with no food.
Typical mind blast injuries. Yes,
blast injuries, or none of the legs, none of the lower limbs anymore.
And what are your treatment experiences with that? So, I saw a lot of tourniquet use in the pictures you had, we also from our department, we had a whole box of tourniquets left from a study we did, and we just packed them up and sent them to Ukraine when the conflict started. But actually, we did not really know if this was what was needed there, because in former conflicts, tourniquet use was increasing, but in civilian life, you use them very rarely. So most of the tourniquets that are put on in the civilian setting have never been needed. So this is for minor bleedings, and people overreact and put on tourniquets. But I could imagine this is a different story in your setting.
Yes. We can see it through the history. There were some times where the tourniquets were loved or hated, right? Because of the specific usage of them. We had situations where they were used in the front line in the wars before, but for example, they were not properly signed into the medical cards, or they were not, the information was not passed, and the casualties would, be covered with blankets or something, and we just wait for hours with the tourniquets on, even in the hospital setting already, right? So we had some increases in limb.
Limb amputation.
Yeah, leg amputations, thank you, because of that, which didn't make any sense. It was just this small thing that made this happen, which then we learned how to deal with it so it wouldn't occur anymore, right? You can see actually the aftermath of this, even in Ukraine, because a lot of soldiers we get, they don't, not only they have the tourniquets that are signed with the time, but also they have it signed like on the forehead or, just here under the neck in the front area, on the uniform, in the card, if they had any. It's like, it's just signed in everywhere. So that's a good thing.
Just to make sure it doesn't get lost, the information. Okay.
Exactly. And when we have medical cards, we always, sign them in, of course, even if they were taken out on the medical point. Still, we say that they were on this limb from this time to this time, which is quite important, I think, for the hospital personnel later on as well. What else? There is a big usage of tourniquets in Ukraine, like massive. What was pessimistic actually at the beginning was we were flooded with counterfeit tourniquets. So that was a big problem. Of course, we had some cuts with the original ones, right? So they needed more, and people started just buying the Chinese ones or creating their own. It was just flooded. The market was flooded with that.
Yes.
Many people just wanted to, make money on this situation, which happens all the time in history, we know. And of course, you can make perfect money on war.
Mm.
We know that as well. So many people even sold to the soldiers or humanitarian aid, which didn't know anything about, medical equipment. They would sell you, for example, the tourniquets you use for, just taking blood. And they would say they're tactical.
Okay.
And they would sell them for the price of the tactical one.
Of course.
They would sell the really cheap Chinese ones as well for the same price.
And do they really break so often? So
I
saw some videos on that, and they seem to break regularly.
Yeah, it's a disaster. It's really, I even tried many of them that were sent just on my leg in my free time. Just each one would break. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen soldiers with much bigger thighs than I have. Yes. And still, the first problem is I couldn't really secure and tighten most of them because they were too short, even for my leg. And second of all, yeah, they would just break constantly, one after another. And yeah, I even did a short film about it because I wanted to show people how it really works. I even, you know, like made the film from scratch, like from the moment I actually opened the package. So it's, no one would say I would, you know, just prepare it in any way. It was just straight from the package and they would just all break. People would 3D print tourniquets as well. And they're also, unfortunately, just shit.
And can you tell them apart? So can you tell which one are the originals and which one is Chinese? So I think this is also a risk. You think you have a good one and your patient has just one chance and you put on a Chinese one accidentally because you can just not as easily tell them apart.
Yeah, actually having a counterfeit tourniquet is worse than not having anything at all because you have this false feeling of being secure and knowing that you have a tourniquet and you will save a life with it and you don't have to, you know, buy or anything else. You don't have to look for it. You're great. You go and you fight. And yeah, and suddenly you get your limp, you step on a mine, you get shot by a drone or by artillery or whatever, or your colleague gets shot. And then suddenly, yeah, you use this tourniquet you have and it just breaks after just a couple of turns. And you're left with nothing, basically. And you're in deep shit. Even if you had two, because you were, let's say, prepared, the second one breaks again. And what do? There is not much you can do in the combat setting in this situation. Yeah, you basically will probably bleed out or die, or your colleague.
Especially if you're wounded yourself, you cannot just handle this with your belt or something.
You'll be lucky if you have a colleague with a normal tourniquet and he might use it on you instead of on himself because the tourniquet we have on ourselves as soldiers are for us, right? So if you're giving away your own, it means if you get shot, you'll die because you don't have another one for yourself. So that's a big commitment. So, yeah, that sucks. And a belt usually won't really give you the proper pressure on the limb, right?
Yes.
It might work on a kid, on a child, maybe, on someone really, really small, maybe on the upper limb. But basically that's it. Everyone else, like a normal adult human being, and especially on the lower limb, right? If you will try to use a belt or anything else like they used to use in the Boston bombing, like this, it just won't work statistically, not a chance.
I also saw some cases in the civilian setting where people try to tourniquet limbs with belts and it never worked. So.
Yeah.
They try
to use like cables, everything they had. And usually, it's just won't work. No mechanical advantage. Usually they're like too thin. So they will even like cut
into the tissue.
Yeah, the tissues. It's really bad.
So if you get some casualty with a tourniquet on, do you leave it on or do you check it? Do you try to release it? What is the strategy behind?
Okay, so our strategy, of course, it depends. My favorite answer for everything.
Yes,
I love it.
Of course, it depends. If there's no leg under the tourniquet, maybe you should leave it on, but if the leg seems to be perfectly fine and it's just a wound, it might be an idea to check or to try to release it a bit.
Well, first of all, we get the wounded directly from the red zone, right? From the trenches, let's say. Sometimes we are very close and the transport, the evacuation will be something like 5 minutes, for example, right? Because we're like next to the positions. And sometimes we are even like 20 kilometers away from the red zone. So it differs, right? And sometimes, even if we are really close, maybe the tactical situation makes it impossible to make the evacuation happen. So we have a lot of delayed evacuations happening. So first of all, the time is really the key here, right? Mm-hmm. Because we need to know how much the evacuation took and what is the time of the tourniquet being placed on the limb. And of course, we're not looking at the perfect, like, you know, 2 or 3 hours or even 4, depending on the book we're using, right? And the norms. We're taking a little bit extra we're being a little bit extra with them. You can usually see if the limb is already, well, dead. You can see if there is nothing you can actually do and you will just leave the tourniquet and he will have to go to the field hospital with it on. And, well, the surgeons will basically amputate the leg, which is certain at one point. You can see some of the pictures on our website where we put this kind of situation there as well. But yeah, most of the limbs are actually really good for rescuing, thank God. And what we will do is, of course, when the time on the tourniquet is right and the limb looks like it's still, well, alive, we will, of course, change the tourniquet to something else, for example, wound packing. And that's the best thing we can do because it's not the occlusion of the whole limb. We can take the tourniquet off and we can create the blood support and the oxygen support to definitely most parts of the leg. So we can save it in very actually easy way. Usually the wound packing is successful. There is no problem with that. And also, we of course try to take off the tourniquets very carefully, right? We observe if there is any bleeding happening. We observe, we want to take our time. So with the potassium, with the myoglobin, with everything like this, we have all the monitoring of the patient, right? So we can look into that. This is all important. But with that said, we had no situations of any heart problems, cardiological problems with any patient that we took the tourniquet off. Not even one out of the million we treated and rescued. Nada.
Yeah, I think this is what people often are afraid of in hospital also. If patients come and have the tourniquet on for quite some time, they are often afraid of reperfusion injuries. But it's very interesting that you say, even if there has been a tourniquet on the leg for quite some time, that this is not an issue in your practice. Very interesting.
Yes, this is interesting for me as well, because I've read the same books and that was something I was afraid of as well. And I remember, you know, of taking them off like really carefully, really slowly, right? Observing everything. And actually, yeah, there was no problem at all. Never in my history of for the 2 years of being in the front line and working there. Nothing. So that is very optimistic, actually. And it kind of changed my perspective on the taking of the tourniquet. And also because of the elongated evacuation, which happens all the time, I actually advise everyone that is in the tactical medical field, everyone that is, you know, teaching, teaching people training, to advise people to actually start trying to wound pack the wounds even earlier. So even before they get to the stabilization point, which is like a CCP point, I would say, maybe in kind of a way, right? because the stages are kind of fluent. They're not like in the perfect book kind of setting. But yeah, we can definitely do it earlier, because if we'll be in the trenches for a long time and we have a longer prolonged field care, right, we can definitely use the time to change the tourniquet or make it lower, right, to do something to save as much as of the limb as we can. Because most of the limbs that are amputated in the hospital setting were actually easy to save before. If someone would change the tourniquet.
Nobody ever tried this.
Yeah, and a lot of the tourniquets are high and tight, the way it changed, but no one actually changed that, right? So even if there would be an amputation in the hospital needed, at least it would be lower, and it would be easier, you know, for the team to later make the prosthesis for the leg. So a lot of pluses with that. I definitely, that is my very strong opinion on that topic.
Sadly, also, this is a learning process.
Unfortunately, yes. Unfortunately for many of the soldiers, which are young men who for the rest of their lives will now live without legs or a leg.
How are your experiences with these hemostatic gauzes, like for wound packing? Do you have, is it, what is your impression? Do they give an advantage over just packing with normal gauze?
That's a great question, actually. Because, out of, you know, my knowledge before, out of the theory, I always believed and said that, of course, there is a difference, but it's like, you know, a couple of percent, right? Because the technique is much more important than the hemostatic itself. But there is a difference, of course. So we, if we can use a hemostatic, it's much better. In the reality of our work, it's really hard to say, you know, for 100%, because every patient is different. We don't often get the feedback from the hospital on the patients, just really rarely. So, you know, we don't have a lot to work with some of the learn how after that with the aftermath. But in my opinion, out of what we see, with the stages we do have the patients, I definitely like the chemostatics, and I think they're doing a good job. And when packing many, many wounds, I've seen a difference. I've seen some difference while packing the wounds when I did it actually with chemostatics. And I did it, for example, in different ways with only a simple gauze. And also, A lot of times we actually were under-equipped, especially in a former stabilization point in Toretsk, to be exact, which is not operational anymore, so I can gladly say the name. We actually used a lot of, we kind of like, we used the scissors, we cut the gauze into smaller pieces, so we would have more. And we used just, you know, like a plastic ball, like straight out of, you know, IKEA or something. And then we would just use a lot of iodine. And we would just put the gauze in the iodine. So it would, you know, like soak everything up. And we had all sorts of iodine, even, you know, the one on the alcohol, which you can imagine how it is on the wound.
Not very pleasant, I think.
It's shit. But sometimes we just didn't have anything else because the wounded would be just coming and coming and there was just not enough equipment. And we would actually pack the wound with this sometimes, which is for, yeah, for me, it was really hard to do because you destroy the tissue, of course, right? It's very painful for the wounded. Yeah, but that was the way we sometimes worked as well.
And if you use the hemostatic agent, do you use one package per wound or do you divide them and use them for two or three or four wounds and just stuff a bit with the hemostatic agent and then put normal gauze after it? Or how do you do it?
we still use, we don't cut them. Even if there is a shortage, we definitely use at least one. If we feel there is a need of use of hemostatic, we use the whole package, mm-hmm. definitely. And actually, if we have a lot of them, if we're not under equipped, we actually use 3 or 4 or 5 in one wound. Mm. That's the like standard. Because one thing that is very specific for me is that there is never enough gas. Mm. Because we were taught that in the like say. Paramedic backpack for this kind of area, for a conflict area of any kind, for active shooter or whatever, right? The tactical medicine, we would, for example, pack, or in the IFAC, right? We would have only like one normal gas, gauze, and one that would be hemostatic, right? Or maybe we would have two, that would be awesome. Well, usually that's not enough. We put like 5 in each wound, and still it's sometimes even more.
Hmm.
But these are the specifics of those wounds that we have there as well, with the shrapnel, not the bullets themselves.
And you just mentioned it, so it is.